Yo! Bitcoin has seen one of its most volatile weeks in history after we saw a record-breaking $1.4 billion heist that occurred last week. This massive Bybit hack from an infamous nation state hacker group has forced many people to reconsider how they hold their Bitcoin. Today, we reached out to a Bitcoin OG with What is happening? There we go. Sorry about that, guys. I have my echo in the background. Today, we reached out to a Bitcoin OG with a decade of experience in cybersecurity to break down everything that happened with this hack. And also this morning, it was Opti and I had to put a fire out, which was absolutely crazy. We had some trouble getting the live stream up and going, which we managed to fix 10 minutes before the show went live. And of course, what Bitcoin OG am I talking about? We have the one, the only legendary Jameson Lopp in the house. Thank you so much for joining us, Lopp. I know we've had you on Simply Bitcoin IRL, but we've never had you on Simply Bitcoin Live. So welcome to the show.
Always glad to talk about Bitcoin.
It's so crazy because every time we have a big guest coming and joining us, those are the days that something goes wrong. So we're rolling with the punches. Anyways, let's jump straight into today's article. Let me pull it up. FBI accuses North Korean-backed hackers of stealing $1.5 billion in crypto from Dubai-based firm. It goes on to say the FBI has accused North Korean-linked hackers of conducting one of the largest thefts of cryptocurrency publicly known, seizing some $1.5 billion worth of Ethereum from a Dubai-based firm. The theft earlier this month, targeting Bybit, one of the world's largest crypto exchanges, represents yet another involving a team of hackers identified by the U.S. government by the names of Trader Trader and the Lazarus Group. The hackers steal cryptocurrency through the dissemination of cryptocurrency trading applications that were modified to include malware that facilitates theft of cryptocurrency. It goes on to say, in an online public service announcement late Wednesday, the FBI said it believed the North Korean-backed hackers were, quote, responsible for the theft. Quote, Trader Trader actors are proceeding rapidly and have converted some of that stolen assets to Bitcoin. I think that's the signal there, right? They're getting rid, you know, of whatever, and they're buying Bitcoin. Other virtual asset dispersed across thousands of addresses on multiple blockchains, the FBI said in its announcement. Quote, it is expected these assets will be further laundered and eventually converted to fiat currency. It goes on to say North Korean state media has not acknowledged either the theft or the FBI accusation. Pyongyang's mission to the United Nations in Geneva did not respond to a request for comment from the Associated Press. Now, here is a post from, I believe, the Bybit CEO, Ben Zhu. And he said, Bybit hack forensic reports as promised. Here are the preliminary reports of the hack conducted by Singa Labs and VeraChains. Screenshotted the conclusion. Here is the link to the full report. And Lop, we were talking about it earlier before we went on air about this report that came out. So Lop, what happened? How did this happen? How can an exchange of this size with this many customers how are exchange hacks still happening in 2025, you know, after the industry has been around for, you know, almost 16 years now? We all remember Mt. Gox. You know, I think Bitfinex got hacked a couple times, Binance got hacked. How is this stuff still happening?
Well, these are complex systems, and, you know, complexity can be the enemy of security. I think that's the short version of how this happened. There's complexity at many different layers, and it really starts at the very lowest layer. There's a lot of complexity on, you know, these EVM Turing complete protocols, and that level of complexity means that you can't have the same trustless verification that we do on Bitcoin if you're using, you know, one of these tiny, low-powered hardware key management devices. So, you know, if you've ever used Trezor, Ledger, Coldcard, really any of those hardware devices, then you know that when you're making a Bitcoin transaction, it explicitly tells you on the screen, hey, you're sending this many sats and you're sending it to this address, and you can confirm it all on what is essentially a totally self-contained computer. And that's possible to do because Bitcoin is simple. And the partially or fully signed transaction that you are sending to that device is usually only a few hundred bytes, maybe a few kilobytes, and it's capable of parsing it and telling you exactly what the resulting change, you know, to the blockchain is going to be. But with these more complex EVM type of protocols, you're not signing a transaction that has all of that context inside of it. You may be signing a more complex transaction that's basically sending a command, you know, to the EVM. And the only way to know what the result of executing that command is to actually execute the command. So you have to have, you know, your own full node, basically, where you do a test and you then check the state change of what actually happened from executing the transaction. So, you know, the short version is that you can't sign these complex transactions on secure air-gapped hardware because the hardware itself simply does not have all of the contextual information necessary to know what the final outcome is of that transaction. And then beyond that, there's just multiple other layers of problems that happened in this one particular case, particularly that they were using a web app, a JavaScript front end to actually drive the creation and the coordination of this multi-sig setup. And anyone who is familiar with JavaScript and web apps know that they are just incredibly difficult to secure because you can't have integrity checks for the code itself. If you're running a mobile app or in many cases a desktop app, those applications can be cryptographically signed. Like the final build of the app can be cryptographically signed by the developers of that app. And that provides a strong attestation and integrity check that the code that you're running is the code that was actually written by those developers. But with JavaScript, that's just not a thing. And so what happened in this case is it appears that Lazarus Group, which is these North Korean state-backed actors, somehow compromised the AWS like S3 bucket or Cloudflare bucket, like wherever this JavaScript was actually hosted. They managed to insert a few lines of malicious code that basically said, hey, if this is the Bybit wallet that is being used to construct and sign this transaction, then do this malicious contract call that completely changes the ownership of the contract. And they were able to do that because, you know, whatever code they put up there just immediately gets sucked down into the browser and run, and there's no integrity checks to make sure that the code was actually written by the Gnosis Safe developers. So they were able to completely bypass any of the security mechanisms that the Safe team may have had around, you know, code review, peer review, the build and deploy process. And it appears that this happened because a developer had some sort of production access API key on their machine, and that machine got compromised. That we don't know all of the details at this time.
So, and it's a couple things. There's so many things to unpack there, right? So the first question that I have for you, Lop, and, you know, of course, we recommend, you know, Bitcoin-only hardware wallets, but I'm sure that a lot of our listeners still use Ledger. It was the Ledger device itself. It's not compromised. It's the fact that it can't lay out all the data effectively on the constraints of the hardware itself and on the screen size. So you can't really actually confirm what it is you're signing. And if you compare and contrast that with Bitcoin, it's pretty straightforward. It's like, look, here's your Bitcoin address. Here's the change address. A lot of good hardware wallets actually lay that out for you, Bitcoin only hardware wallets. So it's not the actual Ledger device itself that was compromised. It was something that was compromised on the software level. How were they able to do that? Did a developer download like a malicious software? Is that what happened?
Probably. It's too early to say because I think the only forensic report that has been released was performed by Bybit or at Bybit's request. I don't know that they actually had access to this supposed developer's machine. over the long term, you would expect that if that's what happened, then a full forensic analysis of any compromised endpoints, you know, employee laptops and other machines should occur, and they should then be able to figure out what is the actual root cause of how it got compromised. But generally what happens in these cases, especially with Lazarus Group, they are considered very advanced persistent threat actors, and they will spend weeks, if not months, poking and prodding and trying to social engineer and compromise various employees at a company in order to eventually get production infrastructure access. So that usually does involve some sort of social engineering to trick an employee into installing some sort of software that has a malicious payload. What we've seen pretty often is that they will go after developers, and in some cases they will try to get the developers to download and run some sort of code from GitHub, usually under the auspice of helping them debug something or helping them do some sort of academic project. And that code in that GitHub project will have a malicious zero-day like exploit that basically allows them to get full access to the machine.
Gotcha. No, it's very interesting. By the way, we're about to break 1,000 live viewers on the live show. If you guys are enjoying Simply Bitcoin Live so far, make sure to smash that like button. Help us break 100 likes within the first 15 minutes of the show on YouTube. We're already at 80 likes. If you guys are enjoying the show, smash the like button. Consider subscribing. Opti, crazy morning, man. The day that Jameson Lopp is joining us on the show, we had to put out some fires in a very short amount of time, but I'm happy that we got the show up and running for you guys. What are your thoughts on this, man? It was a pretty big deal. It tanked the price as well, man. Like, I think it severely affected the price. We were at like 99.5. I totally bought the top. I always do. No shame. Don't care. But it affected the price, right? It dumped the price. I think a lot of people had a lot of questions. A lot of people are like, wait a second, hold on. This dude is using a ledger to sign a transaction for a $1.4 billion transaction. Like, what is going on here? What were your thoughts, Opti?
Yeah, well, obviously, when I saw that video of the ledger, it was like, wait, it's almost like the joke you've been saying for a long time that Brian Armstrong just has a ledger in his sock drawer and that's how he secures the Coinbase transaction. It like literally happened with Bybit. So that was just hilarious. And then just kind of in context, this is a 1.4, that article said about 1.5. I think it's like $1.45 billion hack. Obviously, it's an Ethereum. But in context, this is what, about three times the size of the MT Gox going down. So this is a huge hack here. The Lazarus Group obviously came up huge on this hack, whether it was social engineering or what have you. It's a huge hack. And then before, I actually have a question for Lot before, but it's kind of what you pointed out, Nico. Like, it's funny, and I was joking about this earlier while we were kind of setting up the show. It's funny that even the real scammers out there don't even want Ethereum or any shitcoin, and they just flip it into Bitcoin instantly and try to get it into Bitcoin. You know, a signal for everyone out there that might be Bitcoin adjacent. It's like, even the real scammers don't want these shitcoin scams. They're like, let's put it into Bitcoin. But Lop, for the not so advanced people in the audience, with this hack, just to be completely clear, is this an Ethereum issue or ledger issue? Can this happen on Bitcoin? For someone watching the show right now, maybe they're getting a little scared if their Bitcoin is secured correctly. What would be your advice to them?
I mean, it's a combination of the complexity of some of these protocols and just the way that these hardware devices operate. So, I think the takeaway here is, multisig is not a panacea. Having your keys offline obviously is a good start, but the real question is, when you are actually cryptographically signing a transaction to move funds, how strongly are you verifying exactly what you're signing? And so the problem here is that in most cases, when people are doing multisig transactions on these EVM networks, they're blind signing because, as I said, the hardware simply doesn't have enough information to know exactly what the result of the command that you are signing is going to do to that network, to that blockchain. So you have to have more safeguards in place. You have to have more levels of verification if you are using a, we could call it a non-native multisig contract. Like, the nice thing about Bitcoin is that multisig is baked into the protocol. It's very simple. The downside to these, you know, more generic smart contracting networks is they don't have multisig baked into the protocol. It ends up being a, you know, much more complicated, you know, app, if you will, that is written and deployed onto these networks. And as a result, those hardware devices simply just don't know what to do with it. The one thing that we're seeing, you know, Ledger is talking about, well, no one should be doing blind signing. They should be doing clear signing. And what does that actually mean? Well, it basically means Ledger wants you to be using their enterprise product where they have, you know, a very specific set of smart contracts that their servers are aware of. And then they have additional sets of interactions between your Ledger Live app software that you're running and then the servers on their back end, where it's doing just additional levels of verification back and forth and sending data to your Ledger device so that the Ledger can display exactly what it expects the result to be. So, you know, this is still additional complexity, but I think it's the best that we have to offer at this point in time. And, you know, we've done similar things at Casa where it's you know, a client and server validation, basically checking each other's work. The problem that occurred here with this Gnosis Safe front end is that everything was happening in the browser. Like, there was no other machine, no other full node that was running somewhere that was basically being checked against to see exactly what the result of the transaction was going to be.
Got it.
Interesting. So essentially, and that's actually, so multisig is built natively into Bitcoin, but with the alternative, with the altcoins, it's not built natively into them. So they have to do it via smart contract. And essentially that's where it opens the attack vector, so to speak. Right. And someone in the chat, I think the complexity, and I just want to share this. I just want to share this screen from the Bybit CEO. And it exactly says what Lop was saying. So the benign JavaScript file of app.safe.global appears to have been replaced with malicious code on February 19, 2025, specifically targeting Ethereum multisig cold wallet of Bybit. The attack was designed to activate during the next Bybit transaction, which occurred on February 21st, 2025. So this is extremely sophisticated, Lop. Like, this is not child's play. Like, they knew exactly what they were doing.
Well, they did, because if they had wanted to, they could have been sweeping basically everybody's wallets who were using the Gnosis Safe web app. But, you know, they were smart and they put in that conditional that basically only listed a couple of contract addresses because they didn't want to tip their hand. Like, this is sort of a classic game theory of a zero-day exploit. When you have some sort of massive vulnerability that you're trying to monetize, do you immediately start, you know, trying to sweep up money from everybody? Or do you have a little bit of patience and you basically lie in wait until the big whale comes along? And so that's what happened here, is like, they knew that like that was the biggest possible wallet that was going to be interacting with this code. And so they only had to wait a couple of days to basically get the fish on the hook, so to speak. If they had deployed it without those conditionals, then, you know, you probably would have had people losing a few ETH here and there, and they would have raised the alarm because they wouldn't have understood what happened. And then, you know, that would have resulted in the Gnosis team looking into it and finding the problem before they were able to get the 1.4 billion.
Yeah. Well, it's so wow. Very sophisticated. Is the Lazarus group, very sophisticated target. Just lying in wait until they get the big pot. Now, my question to you, Lop, and I think a lot of people are watching this, how do people protect themselves from this? Like, I mean, from my vantage point, it's like, okay, obviously take self-custody Bitcoin, The simpler, the better, right? In my opinion. So what would your professional advice? You've been around for a very long time in the space. You're obviously, you know, this is up your alley, right? You're a security, I would consider you a security expert. How could people protect themselves from this type of attack?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you stick to Bitcoin and you are using these air-gapped hardware devices to verify the transaction details on the device, then you're going to be good to go. It's not until you start dealing with these more complex protocols where you're basically doing, you know, smart contract commands where you need to have a more sophisticated setup. So, you know, if you are going to go down the route where you're using EVM stuff, you can simply avoid using these smart contracts, and you can just use the native, you know, single signature on chain functionality. And in those cases, your hardware devices will be able to display exactly, you know, what the amounts and destination addresses of your transactions will be. But, you know, if you have millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, you basically need to have a much more sophisticated setup that's managed by a team. And, you know, you really need to be paying a number of different security professionals to try to break your setup and find the weaknesses in it. It needs to be a lot more sophisticated than just using a web app.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that's where, you know, it perhaps it gave them a false sense of security, right? They're like, oh, we're using multi-sig, this is fine. You know, oh, I'm looking at, I like, this is something that I've done over and over and over again. But that's exactly what these social engineering attacks, like, this is what they hope that you kind of fall into this convenience trap. This, oh, I'm safe, my setup is safe. And, you know, they pounce on the opportunity. Not to mention, it was a massive honeypot. Because, you know, if the reward wasn't so great, you know, I don't think they would have gone through the amount of effort. Like, I'm just reading this report, and in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, this must have taken months and months and months of planning and just checking and seeing until, you know, they found a vulnerability. This was not something simple. It wasn't like the Bitfinex hack, which was a total social engineering hack attack. This was like a sophisticated, like, black hat hacker type of, you know, operation.
Though we still really don't know the details of the Bitfinex hack, and that's always been disconcerting. Like, they never really revealed, you know, how the machines got compromised. Like, how did Ilya get production infrastructure access to Bitfinex? There's still so many open questions, and I'm afraid at this point we're never going to get all of the answers to that. But yeah, so, you know, some of the people that have been concerned about this have basically been saying, well, you know, if a multi-billion-dollar exchange can't do self-custody correctly, then how do I know that I can? Well, you know, first of all, you probably don't have $1 billion that you're trying to custody. Like, you're not at the same level of threats that you have against you. So, you know, North Korea isn't going to be sending their hacker squad after you for your, you know, few thousand dollars or even probably for $1 million. They are going after those multi-hundred million and billion-dollar targets. You know, their time and resources are precious, so they're going to go after the big boys. Beyond that, you know, part of the just mile high aspect of security in this ecosystem is we need to stop creating such huge targets. And the way that you do that is you get as many people as possible to take their Bitcoin into self-custody. If the culture is not pushing people to educate themselves and to learn and take the responsibility of self-custody, then the inevitable outcome is the vast majority of people have all of their money in just a handful of trusted third parties, and those are going to be the targets for these state-level actors who, as you said, are very advanced and persistent, and they will spend months and huge amounts of resources because they are backed by a nation state, and they only have to find, you know, one weakness. They only have to win And I only have to like succeed one time in order to have massive catastrophic consequences for many people. And as we've seen, you know, the consequences here actually affect everyone in a way, even the self-custody folks, because whenever a attacker manages to get their hands on millions or billions of dollars worth of crypto assets, what are they going to do? They're going to try to dump it as quickly as possible. You know, first they're going to try to move it around to make it harder for anyone to try to confiscate. I think one of the reasons that they started hopping to other chains was because there was a little bit of rumbling about, well, maybe we could, roll back Ethereum or, make a stake change to Ethereum. But of course, once they start moving to other chains, that becomes practically impossible, infeasible to get consensus to do. But the ultimate medium-term goal, of course, is for them to get out of the entire crypto ecosystem and basically convert it into fiat so that they can fund, whatever their nation-state programs are. Some people speculate that this is going to funding like North Korean military programs. I don't know how much evidence we have of exactly where the money is going, but it's probably nothing good.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things did. I found it interesting that they converted the ETH to Bitcoin, right? I found that interesting. And then, let's see what happens. Cause I saw a lot of people were talking about it, how like they weren't, because all these addresses were being followed, they weren't going to be able to do anything with that stuff. But apparently that's not the case. It doesn't look like the Lazarus Group or any of these, any of these hackers have any intention of giving that money back. That's the way it is. Anyways, guys, before we move on to the next segment of the show, we're going to be talking about the rise of $5 wrench attacks all over the world and what you can do to protect yourself. Also, Lop wrote an article that Jack Dorsey is not Satoshi Nakamoto. Apparently that has been making the rounds on X, that Jack Dorsey is Satoshi Nakamoto. I mean, I could have told you that. I could have said, I have my suspicions. I'll never say them publicly, but Jack Dorsey is not on that list. So we're going to be talking about that, of course. And then during the culture segment, we're going to be talking about Casa. Casa makes self-custody easy. It lets you take all the advantages of multi-sig. But the UI makes it incredibly easy for anyone who doesn't have experience with Bitcoin multisig. It allows it for anyone to just pick it up and get all the benefits of security without the complexity of very sophisticated apps and UI and all that stuff. Casa makes it incredibly easy to do all that. So we're going to be talking about that during the culture segment. It's going to be an incredible show, guys. If you guys are enjoying it so far, we already broke 100 likes on YouTube. Help us break 200 likes. We're almost at 400 live viewers on YouTube alone and 1500 live viewers across all platforms. And of course, shout out to the Rumble audience, which has by far the most savage chat out of everyone. The Rumble audience, I feel like, hits us with the metaphoric 2x4 every single day, nonstop. So guys, it's going to be a great show. Before we jump into it, I do want to give a very special shout out, of course, to Simply Bitcoin's lead sponsor. Simply Bitcoin would not be possible without our partners, and we're very picky on who we choose to partner with. Bitcoin, well, enable your independence with the fastest and safest way to buy Bitcoin on chain or via the Lightning Network in Canada and the USA. To get started, you put in your email address. It takes 2 to 5 minutes to get signed up. And what makes Bitcoin, well, different is that it's a completely non-custodial platform. What does that mean? That means that when you buy Bitcoin on Bitcoin, well, as soon as the funds clear, they go straight to your self-custody Bitcoin wallet address. They don't even allow you the ability to leave your Bitcoin on the exchange, which of course perfectly aligns with the Simply Bitcoin ethos of the separation of money and state, because self-custody is the revolution. Also, if you're a higher net worth individual looking to buy $50,000 worth of Bitcoin or more, check out Bitcoin Well Infinite. It's a white glove experience. You get a dedicated rep which you can call or you can text, you can do email. And every time you want to buy or sell Bitcoin, you have a real human being that you can interact with. So check out Bitcoin Well Infinite today. Go to bitcoinwell.com/OTC to get started. And now, if you're an American, you can get paid in Bitcoin sent directly to your personal Bitcoin wallet. Share your Bitcoin Well direct deposit details with your employer, set your Bitcoin/dollar split, and receive sats instead of fiat with every paycheck. What are you waiting for? Head over to bitcoinwell.com today, scan the QR code, use promo code SIMPLYBTC, get three tosses into the Bitcoin wishing well. Guys, we're going to hit the numbers. We'll be right back.
I want to tell you guys about our sponsor, Stampseed. Is your Bitcoin in cold storage really secure? Are your seed words really secure? Stampseed's do-it-yourself kit has everything you'll need to hammer your seed words into commercial-grade titanium plates instead of writing them down on paper. Don't do that. Paper sucks. You want to literally stamp your seed into this plate of titanium. Your words are actually stamped into the metal plate with this hammer. So once your words are in, they aren't going anywhere. No risk of the plate breaking apart and your pieces falling everywhere. Titanium stamp seeds will survive nearly triple the heat produced by a house fire. They are also crush proof, waterproof, non-corrosive, and most importantly, because this is generational wealth, time proof. All things that paper is not, allowing you to hodl your Bitcoin for the long haul. I mean, here is the plate that they crushed. They put in water. They put a blowtorch to it. And as you can see, the words have survived. Stamp your seed on Stampseed. And you can use promo code SIMPLY to get 15% off anything on their store. Head over to stampseed.com today.
All right, everybody. Could you imagine that conversation many generations? I mean, like 50 years from now, and your grandchildren are looking at you and they're saying, "Grandpapa, are you gonna give me your Bitcoin?" And you look at them in their eyes and you say, "No, because I wrote down my seed phrase on paper." Don't do that. Stamp your seed phrase onto titanium. Go to stampseed.com today. Use promo code SIMPLY, 15% off. At the time of recording, the Bitcoin price is 84,750 block height. That's at a discount, 22% discount specifically. Block height, 885,590. Sats per dollar, 1,180. Market cap, 1.68 trillion. Bitcoin versus gold market cap, 8.3%. Percentage issued, 94.42%. Decline from all-time high, negative 22.4%. Realized monetary inflation, 0.97%. In the grand scheme of things, we're just getting started. I love this number. When me and Opti started covering this, I believe it was at like the 2% level. It's now below 1%. Bitcoin's realized monetary inflation continuing to take fiat currencies to absolute school. And if you buy Bitcoin right now, you're getting it at a 22.4% discount. Bit of a dip. Anyways, I do want to focus on this because I think our friends over at Casa do such a great job making multi-sig easy, making your Bitcoin self-custody setup extremely secure. And a lot of people think that, maybe the wrong episode to say this, but I'm going to say this anyways. But a lot of people think that the biggest vulnerability is their Bitcoin being hacked, right? And there's a Bitcoin being hacked. Like, that's their biggest vulnerability. That's what they think. But in reality, the biggest vulnerabilities to your Bitcoin are two things. You either losing the ability to access your Bitcoin because you made your setup way too sophisticated and you just don't have the technical know-how, so you lose your Bitcoin yourself. And then the other, which is the more physical type of attack, which is the infamous $5 wrench attack. And it seems like those types of attacks have been escalating over time. And perfect, we have the what I consider the master of Bitcoin security on the show today, Jameson Lopp, to talk about all of this. So first, starting off with this article, a Chinese man has been, I can't say that on YouTube, a Chinese man has been taken out on the southern South Korean island of Jeju in what appears to be a cryptocurrency robbery. Here's another one. An in-depth news report on one of the attackers involved in the Danbury kidnapping attempt last year that was linked to a several hundred million dollar Bitcoin heist. Here is the next one. Six men are accused of kidnapping three family members and a nanny from a Chicago townhouse in October and forcing them to transfer $15 million in cryptocurrency before releasing them 5 days later. And last but not least, a specific type of worker named Zapri Outlaw is charged with kidnapping a man she met at a Las Vegas nightclub, taking nearly $300,000 in cryptocurrency from him. The victim might have been under the influence of something. So anyways, Lop, this seems to be happening, seems to be escalating. I think a lot of things, there's trade-offs, obviously, with self-custody. Self-custody comes with personal responsibility, comes with complete responsibility. There is no 1-800 number to call if you've lost your keys, right? And it also, I think, potentially opens you up to a, you know, the infamous $5 wrench attack, right? You know, like everyone's thinking like, oh, it's going to be this sophisticated Lazarus group. But in reality, you buy a $5 wrench and you show up at someone's house and you say, I'm not going to leave until you give me your Bitcoin. And if not, I'm going to use this $5 wrench in ways that you don't like, right? So Lop, like, obviously, you know, you've been doing a great job covering all these events that have been happening worldwide. But first thing that sticks out to me is one happened in Chicago. So one happened actually in the United States, which you would think in the United States that these types of things weren't happening. You, that you've been covering this for so long, is this surprising at all?
I think what we're seeing is that just because you live in a safe area doesn't mean that you're safe from being targeted. Like, these are highly specific, highly targeted attacks. Well, some of them are, right? So I guess we need to break down the different types of attacks, right? So first of all, there's the, like, the crime of opportunity. And so I think the one with the, as you said, specific type of worker, you know, that sounded more like a crime of opportunity. This guy was probably going out, putting himself in a risky situation. He was probably flaunting his wealth or talking about how he was doing a lot of crypto trading stuff. And so that got him targeted just in the moment. Now, I think the things that people should be more worried about, because they're harder to protect against, are the ones where it's a home invasion type thing, where you're getting targeted ahead of time. And, you know, these people, these attackers are putting a lot of effort into, you know, surveilling you, figuring out what your sort of day-to-day activities are, and then essentially taking you hostage. And maybe they do that at your house if they feel like your house is not a hard target. Or in other cases, like last year, we saw a CEO of WonderFi in Toronto. They just waited for him to exit his office at the end of the day, and they threw him into a van when he came out into the parking garage going home from work. So they were likely surveilling him and figured, hey, that's the most vulnerable time for us to pick him up. So, you know, I would say in general, these are still rare, like in the greater context of how many million people obviously are owners of Bitcoin. But we also see the trend. And the trend is that there seems to be a rough correlation between the exchange rate, you know, the general adoption and understanding or awareness of Bitcoin, and the number of criminals who are then trying to apply their own skill set in extracting these valuable assets from targets that are probably not nearly as hard as, you know, trying to hit like an armored car or a bank or, you know, traditional high value target.
Oh, sorry about that. And let me ask you something else, Lop, right? So you broke it down in the specific types of attacks. There's the opportunistic attack, right? With that specific type of worker that I said, YouTube. And then there's the planned attack. It seems like that Chicago attack, that seems like a pretty big heist, $15 million. That seems like a planned attack. That seems like They scouted that person out. Now, my question to you, Lop, and you've written amazing articles on this, by the way. How do you protect yourself against this? Like, you know, how do you go about your life, you know, rethinking your safety and your family's safety, right? Because us Bitcoiners, we have this joke of like, look, I love the Second Amendment and I'm going to make my house into an effing castle. So, you know, like what would be the advice to someone that potentially is, you know, they've been in Bitcoin for a while, they take self-custody, but they haven't really thought about this potential attack vector. What would your advice be to them?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is don't be an idiot. Don't put yourself into risky situations. You know, don't go conducting high value face-to-face trades with large amounts of cash involved, because, you know, that's where a lot of these crimes of semi-opportunity happen, is people targeting the sort of face-to-face OTC traders, getting them to meet up in a sort of secluded hotel room or something like that, and then basically taking them hostage, tying them up, and only performing one half of the trade, as it were. But for the more like long-term targeted stuff with the home invasions and robberies and whatnot, the main thing that you want to focus on is not becoming a target. And how do you not become a target? Well, you shut up. You don't go around, you know, flaunting wealth. You don't broadcast to the entire internet that you're doing stuff with these assets. And preferably, if it's too late for you, if you've already basically doxed yourself as being, you know, a Bitcoin evangelist and holder, then you should take precautions so that it's hard to actually find your address where you sleep at night. That's what I did a number of years ago. It's not easy, but it's feasible, at least in the United States. It can be more difficult in other countries that don't have, you know, some of the same legal options for, you know, protecting your address and your ownership of property and stuff. But privacy, I would say, is the thing that people should be investing in the most. You think of, you know, any security system should be this multi-layered system. So you've got your valuable thing that you're protecting at the center, and then you're sort of ring fencing it with multiple layers of security. You never want to only have one layer of security. You should assume that various security mechanisms are going to get broken through. But at the outermost layer, beyond the actual security, is your privacy. And that privacy layer is very important, because if you have strong privacy, you're not going to get targeted in the first place, and you're not going to have to worry about whether or not your various layers of security are going to fail. So, you know, I do hear people, of course, basically saying, oh, I don't have to worry about this because I have guns and so on and so forth. And look, I'm a big firearm owner myself. There's plenty of photos and videos of me with guns on the internet. And, you know, if it gets to that point, then you are in trouble. Like, it means that all of your other privacy and security mechanisms have failed. And now you're in a sort of last ditch effort to really fight for your life. And of course, there are plenty of things that can go wrong. Like, simply having a gun is not a guarantee that it will be successfully used to defend yourself. I think across the over 200 different incidents that I've measured, only two of them were successfully defended with a firearm by the victim.
And why do you think that is? Like, is it just because you're, again, they have a jump on you, you don't have a jump on them?
Yeah, you can't be hyper-vigilant all the time. Like, unless you're going to go spend like $250,000 a year for 24/7, you know, round the clock bodyguard security, like, nobody has eyes in the back of their heads and everybody has to sleep at some point.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. And, you know, it's one of the trade-offs of self-custody, right? It's one something that I think Bitcoiners all have to really put some thought into. But I agree with you, Lop, 100%. I think privacy is just, that's the easiest one, right? Because if no one knows who you are, there's nowhere to look, right? And then the
go on podcasts with your real name and face. That would be a terrible
idea. A terrible idea. And also, Opti did that for a while.
No, I didn't. You're lying.
You put on a mask for a while.
Oh yeah. I wasn't on forever, and then Nico roped me into not being an on. So now I'm wrecked. Thank you, Nico.
but hey, someone has to talk about Bitcoin. You have to do it, right? This is a very, very fascinating topic, very interesting topic. Lop, if people want to go down the rabbit hole and read some of your articles, where could they find them?
Yeah, check out blog.lop.net. I've got a lot of privacy articles there. And in general, if you want to go down the privacy rabbit hole, you should spend the like $40 or $50 to buy Extreme Privacy by Michael Bazell on Amazon.
Awesome. So you go, we have it in the ticker down below, blog.lop.net. And check out some of Lop's articles. They're some of my favorite. I've been reading them for years. There's one with an image of just like a moat around a house, which it was one of my favorite articles. So yeah, just go check out all this stuff. This is all stuff, guys, that you have to think about if you're taking Bitcoin into self-custody, especially you've been in Bitcoin for a while. These are all things that you have to think about. Think about multi-sig, think about geographically separating your seed phrases, think about decoy wallets. Those are all things that could work to your advantages, to your advantage, but you have to put in the thought, you know. The Spider-Man quote is ringing in my head, right? With great power comes great responsibility. And that's what self-custody is all about. Anyways, guys, we're going to jump into the news segment where we're going to be talking about whether Jack Dorsey is Satoshi Nakamoto or not. So we will be right back. I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Casa. Bitcoin security matters, but managing private keys can sometimes be complicated, especially multisig. What if you can secure your Bitcoin without worrying about losing a seed phrase or giving up custody? With Casa, you can completely control your Bitcoin with multi-key security, so even if one key is lost or stolen, your funds stay safe. No single point of failure, no stress. That's what I absolutely love about these guys. They make taking Bitcoin into self-custody incredibly easy with their best-in-industry user experience through their app. I've been personally recommending Casa for years now to my friends and family because they will get all the benefits of multi-key self-custody security without the hassle of having to learn complicated UI. And if you're thinking of one day passing on your Bitcoin to the next generation, their inheritance plan has you covered. Also, if you're a business looking to add Bitcoin to your treasury, do it the secure way with Casa for Business. To get started, go to casa.io today and get 5% off Casa Standard or Casa Premium with promo code SIMPLY. I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Foundation. It's self-custody done right. They've built a premium-grade hardware wallet called Passport right here in the US, and it integrates seamlessly with their free app called Envoy. Passport is fully open source and verifiable. It's the most intuitive Bitcoin wallet designed with a UX reminiscent of a classic feature phone, so you'll know how to navigate it and use it the moment you pick it up. It's also air-gapped, meaning Bitcoin stays offline, never touching an internet connection. It's Bitcoin only, open source verifiable, air gap security model, gorgeous design craft, premium grade materials. Get your Bitcoin off exchanges and into your own hands in just a few minutes with Passport at foundation.xyz/simply. Get peace of mind for your piece of Bitcoin. All right, everybody, this is Opti. And Opti is not holding a Nokia. He's holding a Passport by Foundation Devices. And if you use promo code SIMPLY, you will get a discount. Not on Opti, but on the Passport by Foundation Devices. Remember, guys, not your keys, not your cheese. This device is completely open source. It's completely air-gapped. And it doesn't sacrifice security for convenience. Get yourself a Passport by Foundation Devices today. Take self-custody. Not your keys, not your cheese. All right, everybody, let's talk about this gentleman right here, Jack Dorsey, which Lop believes is Satoshi Nakamoto. No, just kidding. That's a joke. Lop, you dropped this article on your blog, blog.lop.net. The title of the article for the audio listeners is Jack Dorsey is not Satoshi Nakamoto. compilation of evidence that Jack Dorsey could not be the creator of Bitcoin. So let's go through some of that. Lately, some folks have been pushing a half-baked narrative that Jack is Satoshi, and you could find the arguments here. First one from Sean Murray. Why Jack Dorsey is Satoshi Nakamoto? Jack Dorsey was one out of the 1,300 confirmed cyberpunks in 1996 in his UMR email. Wore an Adam Back t-shirt in the UMR yearbook. UMR students were called miners. Was a computer science and math major with an interest in crypto. Continues to go. Anyways, you guys get the point. Back to Lop's blog. And here, this is Matthew Siegel. He says, in the spirit of full disclosure and intellectual honesty, prosperity's judgment, and rigorous debate, I would like to share my strong belief. I have become personally convinced that Jack Dorsey, CEO of Square and founder of X, is Bitcoin's founder, Satoshi Nakamoto. And he posted, this was April. This was February 18th. This was February 15th. Wow. Okay. This is all coming all around the same time, but you know, and Lop says, here we go again. 2014, we found Satoshi. Turns out he was hiding in plain sight and we listed in the phone book. 2025, we found Satoshi. Turns out he was hiding in plain sight and appearing on national television wearing a Satoshi shirt. I have to play the meme. Here we go. Anyway, it continues to say, it's true that Jack was a cypherpunk and a programmer, but that's the strongest evidence available to support this theory. Everything else is circumstantial, if not outright mental gymnastics via numerology. I will once again point out that Satoshi hunting is a dick move, and thus I once again find myself interested in discrediting said dicks. If you're going to post a Satoshi claim, you should put as much effort into trying to disprove your own thesis as you do trying to improve it. Otherwise, you risk looking like a fool. Accusing someone of being Satoshi without providing bulletproof evidence makes you a massive asshole because you're painting a target on them. It continues to say, the funny thing about Jack is that, unlike most cyberpunks, he was an extremely public individual who posted what he was up to on nearly an hourly basis. During 2009 and 2010, Jack posted over 6,200 tweets. This gives us a much larger data set to work with compared to Satoshi, who created fewer than 1,000 timestamped events during the same period. A little common sense. During that time period of 2009 and 2010, Jack Dorsey was not only chairman of the board of Twitter, but also the CEO of the fledgling startup Square. It's quite clear that he was an extremely busy person, not only overseeing multiple companies, but traveling around the world, meeting important people, doing press conferences, speaking at conferences, and promoting philanthropic causes and more. His activities do not fit the profile of someone who had the time and mental bandwidth to also be.
Did we lose Nico?
It seems like it.
Okay, okay. Oh, wait, he's back.
Oh, did I drop out?
Yeah, for a second. You're back.
What part did I drop out of?
The persona part.
Oh, okay. All right. Perfect. I mean, so everything, the little common sense, all that. Okay. Yeah. Anyways.
And so the my point here about Windows is that we know Satoshi was building on Windows. The first version was Windows only. So I should clarify that.
Yeah. So Lop, first of all, excellent article, kind of debunking all of this. What motivated you to do this? I mean, it's kind of self-explanatory. You feel like these people are dicks. Why are they dicks for trying to expose Satoshi Nakamoto?
Yeah, I guess I leave that to the very end, the conclusion, in which I basically say that, look, Satoshi should be an idea and a myth. You know, I think we are all Satoshi. You know, Satoshi left the project to us. The problem comes in when you try to paint Satoshi as a singular figure of a human being. You know, a human being is fragile, as a single point of failure, is going to be human. They're going to have said or done probably controversial things that people are going to dig into and try to use to basically cast aspersions upon the entire Bitcoin project. So as a result, I think Bitcoin is stronger when there is no, you know, single human point that people can basically try to denigrate.
100%. And I think that's something that Bitcoiners fundamentally understand. I think if you've been in Bitcoin long enough, you understand that it's actually better that Satoshi's identity is never discovered, because if it is discovered, it essentially connects his identity to a mortal, to a human being. Human beings have flaws, right? Human beings, you know, they have to sleep, they have to do other things, right? They have to eat. But if he remains this mythological figure, there's really no flaws there, right? You only have certain interactions that he's had. I know in the CSW lawsuit, it was very interesting to see some extra communications that Satoshi had that wasn't exposed to the public, right? So I fundamentally agree. I think the less we know about Satoshi, the better. I think that if you've been in Bitcoin long enough, you've come to realize that knowing the identity of Satoshi is not important. It's what Satoshi did is important. And I think it would be actually a negative to the industry and to the movement, because this is really what Bitcoin is, if we discovered his identity. I don't think that's ever going to happen, by the way. And I don't think those coins are ever going to move, by the way, also. I think that he fundamentally understood that he created something bigger than himself. And that's why he walked away and left it to its own devices. And here we are 16 years later, and we're talking about nation state adoption and all that stuff. So it's been a tremendous success. So if you're still trying to discover Satoshi's identity, you don't get Bitcoin. That's my take. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my opinion. Opti, what's your take on this, brother?
Yeah, well, I'm with Lop on this one. I don't think Jack Dorsey is Satoshi. And I don't really need any evidence for this. It's just a vibe check here. It makes no sense to me. And I find it interesting, though, part of this idea, like you were saying, Nico, if you are trying to find out who Satoshi is, you don't understand Bitcoin. I find it interesting that usually for a lot of new people in Bitcoin, this is like their one caveat. This is the one thing that they always say that, you know, makes them not trust Bitcoin. And us Bitcoiners are completely opposite. It's like, this is a good thing that we don't know who Satoshi is. Whereas most people come in, it's like, how could you trust this internet money thing with an anonymous creator? Like, don't you want to know who it is? And I'm like, no, it doesn't matter. This is the beauty of it. This is the whole point, that the creator came anonymous, gave us a gift and disappeared like Batman. And this is why no one controls the network. But an interesting kind of take on this is that those Bitcoiners on Twitter that are saying this, they're not like newbie Bitcoiners. And so I find it kind of interesting that they are pushing this narrative. And I wonder what the incentive is. And, you know, that's kind of my take on this. It's like, it's not like they're new people into the space that are saying this. They've been around for a couple of years and now they're pushing this. So that's like the things that gets me kind of wondering, like, what is the incentive to push that Jack Dorsey is Satoshi? But yeah, like I said, it's usually newer people in the space that come in and they wonder who Satoshi is. And all of us here that been around for a while, we're like, dude, it doesn't matter. I don't care. I literally don't care. I don't ever want to know. I hope he never comes out. But it's funny that when new people come in, they always ask the same questions. Like, how could you trust this money? You don't even know who created it. I'm like, this is a good thing. What are you talking about? Yeah, do you even understand what's going on here?
I think that some people just want to have a hero or a leader figure, and that, you know, it would be cool if Satoshi happened to also be this guy who's a billionaire and one of the richest people outside of the Bitcoin that Satoshi mined. I think that's a similar reason why some people have floated the Elon Musk theory, which is, you know, similarly ridiculous. But, you know, people come in and I think they want to know who Satoshi is because they think that there might be a backdoor in the code. You know, Satoshi could be the NSA or the CIA, and it doesn't matter because we know what the code does. We can look at it. It's open source. It's been reviewed by countless individuals who have tried to find weaknesses in it for 15 years now. And then I think some other people are slightly worried about the economics aspect of, you know, one person controlling such a large portion of the supply. And I tend to agree with Nico that the coins are never going to move. I have a blog post a few years ago entitled "Satoshi Was Not a Greedy Miner," in which I go into the really deep technical details of Satoshi's mining operation. And I show that they actually mined a lot slower than they could have. And so my thesis for Satoshi's mining operation is that it was never meant to accumulate coins. It was really meant to act as a heartbeat for the network. And you can actually see that Satoshi would stop mining for 5 minutes after finding a block to basically give the rest of the world a chance to try to find a block. And then over the years, Satoshi actually decreased their hash rate as the hash rate of the rest of the network increased. And so that was because they no longer needed to be that stabilizing force to ensure that blocks were still being produced at a consistent rate in those very early days.
100%. No, and he was and I remember some of the earlier communications, Lop, to add to your point, he was like basically saying, like, guys, like, calm, you know, like, let's make sure that this hash is distributed, right? Like, let's calm down. Because in the beginning, it was very delicate. You can even make an argument that it was centralized. Lop, isn't there a story that essentially Satoshi ran Bitcoin in stealth in the very, very early days on purpose?
I'm not sure what you mean by stealth. I mean,
like,
I
think he was running the software by himself.
No, like, there were other early miners, even in the first, you know, day or so of blocks. If I recall correctly, there was actually some logic in the Bitcoin client at the time where it would not start mining blocks until there was at least some other peer connected to the node.
Interesting. So someone else had to. Is that, I don't want to ask what that person is, but I mean, like some of these people are public, are they not?
Yes, we do know some of the very early miners, and then there are plenty of those early blocks that, as far as we know, have not been attributed to any specific identity.
Yeah, those guys, they're doing it right. They're doing it right. They're watching all this content. They're going to the conferences.
They're not going to the conferences.
No, they might. You have no idea. You would have no idea, right? Anyways, all right,
hey,
guys.
Hey, wait, Nico, before we go on, yeah. Since we got Lop here, SpongeBob SquarePants in the chat has a question here, and I think Lop's perfect person to ask. Why hasn't Satoshi's wallet been hacked?
Well, the keys might have been destroyed. I think there's plenty of reason to believe why the keys are no longer laying around. Like I said, my takeaway from looking into Satoshi's mining activities was that it was actually a very specialized machine. It was running specialized multi-threaded mining software that was not like public open source mining software. It was not the software that was built into the Bitcoin client at the time. And so that's, you know, another reason why I believe that Satoshi basically just had that infrastructure running to keep the network going for those first 18 months to 24 months. And then once the network seemed like it had bootstrapped itself, they turned it off. So, you know, what happened to those keys? Maybe they destroyed them. Maybe they still exist, but I think it's basically that money is like too hot. Like, I don't know how you would actually spend any of that money without putting yourself at extreme risk of being doxxed.
100%. I 100% agree with that. And I do, before we move on to the next segment, I do want to end or you know, finish off some of the reasons as to why Jack Dorsey is not Satoshi. Lop lined it up here. It says, I'm sure Jack used Windows at some point in his life, but he has been a diehard Apple fan ever since the original iPhone came out. And he says, can't use my computer because both my Magic trackpad and keyboard are out of batteries. And it says, most of the evidence in this report is based upon timestamps, meat-space activities. Jack was bi-coastal in 2009 and 2010, frequently alternating between San Francisco and New York, because those were the locations of Twitter HQ. And then I think this is the most interesting one right here. I think out of the things that you've posted, Lop, this to me is, I mean, like, unless Satoshi could be two places at the same time. Like, I feel like Jack Dorsey just planning all of this. You know, but anyways, so Satoshi's public activity hour of the day, and then here is Jack Dorsey's Jack Dorsey's tweets hour of the day. Obviously, he needs to be awake to tweet. I mean, I don't know, Lop. He could be this sophisticated shadow coder and be planning his tweets.
Yeah. Technically, like, any activity can be automated, right? But, you know, you kind of have to go with the Occam's razor on these things. Like, is the more complicated question or answer to it really the more likely one? I think not.
I have a question for you, Lop. Like, It seems like Satoshi, based on this, what seems like he was on the U.S. time zone.
It really lines up well with what you would consider to be a typical waking and sleeping schedule of someone on the Pacific time zone.
Interesting. Very, very. Okay. All right, everybody, we're going to move on to the culture segment. We have tons to cover and tons to talk about. We're going to be talking about Casa. It makes multi-sig easy. It makes self-custody easy. This is an app that I've been recommending to friends and family because I want them to have all the benefits of taking self-custody, but also not losing their keys. I don't know how many times I've found myself in this situation where either, you know, just family members of mine, they're like, Nico, I lost my seed phrase. I'm like, don't worry, we can just replace it, right? So the Casa app enables that, makes it easy. So we're going to talk about all of that. We're going to hit the culture segment. We will be right back.
I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Hive Digital Technologies. As the first ever public miner, Hive's been battle tested through every possible market. And as the first with an AI strategy, Hive continues to redefine the future of sustainable energy. Also, gotta casually drop this in here. Hive consistently tops the industry in Bitcoin mined per exahash. They're lean and mean, they're green and clean, and they're changing the game. Learn more by following them at Hive Digital Tech or check out their website, hivedigitaltech.com. I want to give a very special shout out to our sponsor, Compass Mining. They make Bitcoin mining accessible to everyone, from beginners to experienced investors. Their turnkey miners gets you online and hashing within 48 hours, making it easier than ever to start your mining journey. Plus, with their active marketplace, you can resell your miner at any time, adding flexibility and value to your investment. Visit their website to access a wealth of resources, learning everything you need to know about Bitcoin mining. Take your first step into the world of Bitcoin mining with confidence. Discover more at compassmining.io. Again, compassmining.io, and see how Compass Mining can power your success.
All right, everybody, we are back. Guys, so we're going to talk about Casa. And of course, we have Jameson Lopp here in the house joining us today on Simply Bitcoin Live. Jameson is the CTO of Casa. Jameson, quick elevator pitch. If you had 1 minute in an elevator with someone and they're like, Jameson, what is this Casa thing? How would you describe it?
So basically, we help you be your own bank. And we make it easy to do so because, you know, when you are setting up essentially your own bank security, there's many, many different decisions to be made, many best practices to be followed. And if you're not deep into the weeds of all of that, then it's very helpful to have software that basically guides you down following best practices and to have actual humans that you can talk to who can help you understand the trade-offs of the different decisions that need to be made.
Great. And I love that phrase. We help you be your own bank. That's a very, very powerful statement. And I agree. I think, you know, taking Bitcoin into self-custody, especially with multi-sig and all the capabilities that that gives you, you feel like your own bank. It's badass AF. Opti, do you have any questions before I move on?
Yeah, definitely. So when we were starting the show, I asked Lop, what's the main message you want to get across to our audience? And Lop said it very simply, that we are fighting an uphill battle of convenience when it comes to self-custody. So can we elaborate on that for the audience? I know our audience is pretty much, most of them are self-custody maximalists, but we still see some people that are on the fence about taking their Bitcoin into personal custody.
Yeah, I mean, beyond just, you know, our operations as a company, you know, this is a systemic issue for the entire ecosystem. And my sort of black pill view of privacy and security is that, you know, unfortunately, human nature is to prioritize convenience at the expense of almost everything else. And we know that, using a trusted third party to hold your money for you is always going to be the most convenient thing. Basically, pushing off all of the responsibility to someone else is easy. And we do that in many different aspects of our lives. So it's basically second nature to us. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to make it as easy as possible, reduce as much friction as possible, so that people can be more confident to take that responsibility. And we want people to be able to sleep at night with the understanding that, you know, they can do self-custody without screwing it up and without having to worry that, you know, there's a weakness somewhere or that, you know, one thing might go wrong and be catastrophic. So that's everything that we're doing, is to put people into an architecture that eliminates single points of failure, because we understand things go wrong, humans make mistakes, and you don't want to be in a really brittle setup where one thing going wrong results in you losing all of your assets.
Totally. Lop, you've been in Bitcoin for a long time. You're a cybersecurity expert. From your vantage point, from where we are today, do you think self-custody, or rather the idea of people self-custodying, do you think that's going to improve, or is this, will this always be a niche idea for the like average mainstream layman?
I suspect that in relative terms, as we go more mainstream, that the vast majority of adoption will happen through trusted third parties. I think that's just the reality of the situation, at least in our lifetimes. The problem here, it really is, I think, cultural, and it's a result of how human civilization has developed over millennia, is that we have created these economic powerhouses that have been able to leverage extreme efficiency and performance gains through specialization of tasks. And so we've created these systems where you're outsourcing the vast majority of the, you know, important aspects of your lives to third-party specialists, because they're going to be better at doing something than you are if you had to do everything yourself. Like, this is why it's so much easier and efficient for us to go to the grocery store than it is to grow our own food and slaughter our own animals. However, while that's convenient and it's efficient, it is also fragile. It's creating all of these potential points of failure, such that, you know, if the supply chains for food and delivery of important, you know, medicines and other physical items broke down, you know, we'd be in pretty dire straits within a week or two with the way that modern society is architected. So that similar thing basically trickles down to, you know, where we are with self-custody. You know, people who have bank accounts are used to the idea of having all of their money in a trusted third party who's managing it for them. And so this is, as a result, is kind of a cultural issue where I suspect that it could take generations for us to kind of reverse course on that and really teach our children and our grandchildren to take responsibility for some of these extremely important aspects of their lives.
Totally. Yeah, I very much agree that it's a culture issue. Now, you did kind of mention about businesses and Bitcoin treasuries. So as someone that is working on a Bitcoin treasury product, how big of a product or a problem do you think that these honeypots are, like Coinbase and et cetera, in the space right now? We know a lot of the Bitcoin ETFs are all custodied essentially at the same companies. And obviously, it's your kind of life motto here. Your life purpose is to obviously distribute that security away from these honeypots. So how big of an issue do you think this is? And is this something that you think, you know, that keeps you up at night? Do you think we might see another, I don't know, exchange blow up? Like, what's your thoughts on that perspective?
Well, I mean, look at what happened last week, right? Like, it's not stopping. I mean, we are improving security best practices, but security is a cat and mouse game. It's a never ending battle. And so as this ecosystem continues to grow and the total value of the ecosystem grows, and then the total value of the, you know, single points of failure honeypot custodians continues to grow, then that means that the attackers are incentivized to spend even more resources trying to find the weaknesses in them, because the payoff of a successful attack is also growing. So, you know, I think that in terms of risk, it's just, it's better to distribute risk across millions of different points such that, you know, if the average individual has a failure and their self-custody gets successfully attacked, yes, it could be very bad for that individual, but there's no, you know, ripple effects across the rest of the ecosystem where you don't have like one failure causing hundreds of thousands or millions of people to lose their money instantaneously. And then you don't have the economic pressure, as we talked about earlier, of, you know, $1 billion worth of liquidity trying to be extracted from the system as quickly as possible by the attackers.
So, Lop, we have a it seems like we have a Casa user in the chat. So I don't know how to pronounce that. Opti, you want to give it a go?
Psycho.
Yeah. 05 says, Lop, can we have foundation and cold cards for signing devices? I haven't used Casa because we get sent treasures.
We support both of those devices, and you know, you can either buy them for yourself off the shelf, or it really depends on like which tier you're at. I think we only really offer the customization of hardware at the private client tier, if I recall correctly. But you can definitely buy any of our supported devices. We support the cold card Mark IV and the Q both seem to work pretty well as Foundation Passport. It just it depends on if you prefer doing the like a QR code based signing or not, and that can be a bit tricky. I have several articles about multi-sig performance testing of like signing really large data size transactions.
Yeah, and let me ask you something else, Lop. So maybe. In the chat, this applies, right? And the reason that I love the Casa product is, again, it makes the whole self-custody aspect easy without sacrificing convenience. And I think you guys have mastered the UI. Your UI is incredible. It even has a little haptic tick to make you feel good when you sign something, right? And I think that makes it very easy for someone that perhaps is transitioning from the fiat standard, the fiat matrix, to a Bitcoin standard where they're taking self-custody. And it kind of gives them the same vibe of, oh, this is like a bank, but it's not a bank because it's self-custody. So you guys cover a lot of the complexities there. What would your pitch be to someone like, you know, like, hey, look, I already have a single sig and I'm using, you know, I'm using a Passport, I'm using a cold card, and, you know, I have Sparrow, like, you know, why should I use Casa?
Now, look, if you are comfortable with using the totally free tools that are out there, then go for it. Nothing that we do can't be replicated by someone if you put in enough time and effort to do so. And in fact, like if you want to try to replicate everything that we've done, I highly recommend that you look up our wealth security protocol. And that is several dozen pages explaining all of the threats that we're trying to mitigate and exactly what steps that and decisions that we made in our architecture to mitigate those threats. But really, I think a lot of it comes down, as I said earlier, to convenience, to really providing a very simple user experience. Like on purpose, we do not offer a lot of the more advanced functionality that you can do with Bitcoin. And that's because we think that it's actually kind of dangerous. You know, it could be a foot gun in the hands of an unsophisticated user. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to build a super high security, you know, cold storage setup that eliminates single points of failure and is accessible to a non-technical user that you may not know all of the ins and outs of the protocol and security best practices and such. So what you're really doing is you're saving yourself a lot of effort of having to learn all of those best practices and put them into place. But it's certainly possible to do it yourself. And, you know, I think that's one of the great things about Bitcoin. Like, you don't need us to self-custody. We're really here to help you get into the best possible position as quickly and as easily as possible.
100%. And someone who, it learned multisig specifically using Electrum and Sparrow. There's different standards. People don't realize this, right? If you don't update your devices, all of a sudden it's like, wait a second. Oh my God, I can't spend, right? There's a lot. It's a very deep rabbit hole, ladies and gentlemen. Electrum crashes when you like it. There's so many, like, you know, and that's what I love about Casa is that you guys make this easy. You guys make something that is highly complex, easy to use for the everyday user. And of course you guys offer support and all that stuff. Now, my question to you, Lop, is, so you guys offer a 2 of 3 and a 3 of 5. And for anyone who doesn't know, so the 2 of 3, the user holds two of the three keys. Casa owns one, or not owns, but holds one key. And then for the 3 of 5, Casa holds one key, the user holds 4. One of the keys is on your phone, which is backed up to iCloud or the Google equivalent. And then the rest of the three keys, the user holds. Now, what's really interesting about the 3 of 5 is that it actually feels like you're signing a 2 of 3, because the phone key, it's like as soon as it's, you know, you put in your phone password with your face or your fingerprint, it signs automatically, right? So the experience is very pleasant, in my experience. And let me ask you something, Lop. So what happens if Casa disappears? You know, could people still access their Bitcoin? Like, for whatever reason, the app is pulled from the app store, you know, something funky happens. You know, could people still sovereign recover their Bitcoin?
Absolutely. And because we're not doing anything proprietary here, we're not doing any sort of like proprietary multi-party computation or Shamir secret sharing or anything like that. We're doing the, you know, native on-chain multi-sig, which means that there are many other wallet software out there that supports the same thing. So, you know, we added wallet descriptor support last year. That makes it really easy to, you know, export and import the sort of skeleton, you know, descriptor of your wallet. And, you know, you can import that into like Electrum or Sparrow, you know, any other wallet that supports sort of arbitrary, complex multi-sig setups. And the first thing that actually happens when you finish initializing your multi-sig vault with Casa is that we send you instructions for what we call sovereign recovery. And that's basically, you know, if Casa ceases to function or exist or for whatever is not working, then you have the, you know, step-by-step instructions for how to recreate your wallet and spend your funds without ever relying upon our software or our infrastructure. So I say this a lot, but the primary point of Casa is to eliminate single points of failure, and that includes Casa itself as an organization.
Yeah, and you guys do a very good job at that, because I've been in situations where, and I mentioned this earlier, where someone loses one of their keys on their multi-sig setup. It's incredibly easy to replace. You press a button, a little haptic, makes you feel good about losing your key, sends you an email, you plug in your new device, and boom, bam, bing, you know, your wallet is good to go. Without that UI, you don't know. The only way you know is by trial and error. And it took me a while. And, you know, Sparrow wasn't around. But so I had to learn a lot of this stuff on Electrum. And I'm still an Electrum junkie, and I love Electrum, despite what people say. Okay, it's a great wallet. You guys essentially make a very sophisticated thing, incredibly easy to use, without sacrificing security. And it's convenient for people that want to benefit from multi-sig, but again, don't have the technical capability or technical know-how to go down that. Now, my question to you, Lop, as well is, so let's talk about geographically multi-sig, geographically separated keys, right? Because I think that is incredibly important, especially if you're using multi-sig. Could you talk a little bit about that, right? Keeping your keys in different locations, and that obviously helps protect you from, $5 reg attack, which we were talking earlier. And there's something that you've said in the past that really resonated with me and I've never forgotten. It will take an attacker just as much time to spend your Bitcoin than it takes you to spend your Bitcoin. And that's the way that you should be looking at it, right? So if it takes you 10 minutes to, you know, sign a transaction, send your Bitcoin out of cold storage, in your mind, the back of your mind, you'd be like, it will take an attacker 10 minutes to send Bitcoin, whatever. But if you know that your multi-sig set up and your keys are geographically separated, so it takes some couple hours to go, you know, from place A to place B and et cetera, then it becomes a little bit more complex, right? And then it's not just a, you know, let me just jump in here, stay a couple hours. Now it's like, oh my God, this might take a couple days. Obviously, that raises the risk for the attacker himself. So it's just some things to talk about. So could you talk a little bit about that, Lop? Geographically separated keys for multisig?
Well, yeah. So the name of the game when it comes to building the best possible multisig setup, because multisig in and of itself is not panacea. You know, if you keep all your keys at home, then congratulations, you've introduced a single point of failure to your multisig setup. Distributing the keys in as many different ways as possible is what gives you a great strength. And it lets you leverage the benefit of what we call additive security. It's basically strength through diversity. And this is diversity in a number of different things. You know, you mentioned geographic diversity, but also you want diversity of like what devices they're stored on. What are the physical security protocols around where each device is? And basically, you want all of these things to be different, because when something goes wrong, you want that particular attack or failure scenario to only affect one of your keys and not affect all of your keys. And when you're in a more of a homogeneous setup, then it's more likely that you have one weakness that could potentially affect enough of your keys that either your money gets lost or stolen. So, you know, having geographic separation, yes, I mean, it's obviously, that's the way to protect against wrench attacks. But even more commonly, it's just how you protect against natural disasters and, you know, things going wrong, like your house burning down. We've had clients whose houses burned down. We've had clients who have been in flood zones and have, you know, had various types of catastrophic destruction to their primary residence. And so having, you know, keys in different geographic areas that are, you know, prone to different types of weather and natural disaster events gives you some improved, you know, robustness there. If you want to take it to the extreme, not just upon like wrench attacks, but upon like nation state 6102 seizure style attacks, our most paranoid clients actually go to the extreme of distributing their keys in different countries, different jurisdictions that, you know, do not play nicely with each other, so that, you know, it's unlikely for a 6102 attack to be able to, you know, reach across borders and be able to force the turning over of those keys that are, you know, outside of the reach of any given justice system.
Yeah, maybe, love the way, guys, this is all things that you got to think about. These are all things, again, with great power comes great responsibility. That's what self-custody is all about. CASA makes it incredibly easy if you feel intimidated by the tech stuff. And I'm telling you, someone who loves computers, the trial and error that I had to, and the mini heart attacks, no one tells you that, right? The trial and error of having to learn this stuff was not a walk in the park. So this is a great way. Especially if you hold a decent amount of Bitcoin, you should definitely have it on multi-sig. Like I can't recommend that enough. I think a single sig is just like, it's a terrible idea in so many different
ways. A single point of failure. It's right there in the name.
Yeah, exactly. So if you've been in Bitcoin for a while, I highly, highly recommend multi-sig, and CASA makes it incredibly, incredibly easy without sacrificing security. I want to give a very special shout out to our guest today, Jameson Lop. Go check out his blog, blog.lop.net. And of course, go check out Casa. Go to casa.io/simply. Of course, today's show was February 27, 2025. I'm your host, Nico. Our guest today, Lop. And of course, my legendary co-host, Optimus Fields. We'll see you guys tomorrow for a brand new episode of Simply Bitcoin Live.
Today's episode was brought to you by BitcoinWell.com, a Bitcoin-only platform on a mission to enable financial independence.